Well, let's continue then with the subject, the complexity of life. You see, as we started out by saying in our initial presentation, this is a very significant issue for everyone. Because somewhere along the line, we need to determine why we exist, where we have come from. And I would think that every one of you at one time or another has thought about this. It is very important. Why do we exist? By chance? Or because there's a creator? Well, for many of us, it seems very obvious. And one of the major arguments that people often present is, my body is very complex. And you've all heard this argument about Paley's argument about the watch. A watch requires a watchmaker, doesn't it? Then what about the human body? See, evolutionists say it's not necessary. And the objective of our presentation here today will be to look at the complexity of life. What makes us, the complexity of the cells, of the systems that makes up our own body. And if a watch requires a watchmaker, what about you and me? Can that be verified that there is a creator? Well, with regards to the complexity of life, there are two choices. The evolutionary view that life exists because of random chance. All the complexity that we see, they say, can simply be understood given matter, chance, and time. But the opposite of that, in the other worldview, which is a creation worldview, says there has to be an intelligent designer. And of course, the Bible says that intelligent designer is the creator. And more specifically, as we've already quoted from Scripture, the intelligent designer, the creator, is Jesus Christ. Let us examine this topic of the complexity of life. This is a very simplified diagram of a cell. And the reason I show this cell is because it means something to me. It's very important, and I will tell you why. Often people want to know, what was it in your life that caused you to change? Well, there were many things, but here's one. See, one day I was sitting down and I was reading from a biology textbook that I had looked at many times before. And I'd been reading for an hour or so, and I laid the book down and I placed it on a table. And for some reason I started to look around the room. And on the wall before me, there was a painting. Well, that painting had hung on the wall for years. But for the first time in my life, when I looked at this painting, the thought came into my mind. The painting was painted by an artist. And then I looked down at the book in front of me, the book that I just laid down, and the thought came to me, well, I could see the author's name on the title page. It had been written by an author. And then I looked at the table that the book was sitting on, and, well, that was a table that I had constructed during woodworking class in high school. And when I opened the book, the biology textbook, back to the page where I had closed it, I saw this diagram of a cell. And something came to me for the first time, and that was the reality that life was very complex. And that if paintings required artists and books required authors and tables required carpenters, what about life? That was a major step for me. You see, the cell is supposed to be the simplest unit of life. But everyone knows that a cell is not simple. A cell is very, very complex. And within the cell wall, we see a number of structures, and these structures have particular functions. And so we look at another more sophisticated cellular diagram, and we can see more of these structures. How did they come into existence? You see, a cell is like a factory. how could a factory containing all of these specific structures with functions evolve? Remember, scientists admit the possibility of a protein molecule evolving is 1 over 10 followed by 56 zeros. What about the cell? Well, I'm going to read to you the definition of various cellular structures. And this is something you don't need to memorize, but I just want you to think about it as we look at these structures and we give you the definition of what they are, what they do. Membrane proteins. These molecules span the exterior cell membrane and act as a monitor for informing the cell what is outside its boundaries. These definitions are from various biological textbooks, usually high school textbooks. The second, endoplasmic reticulum, a network of channels which stores and carries proteins from factory locations to other locations in the cell. Ribosomes, they are factory locations for the production of proteins. Lysosomes, they are structures that act as digestive organs, breaking down food into particles the cell can use for cellular processes. The Golgi apparatus, structures that support proteins, carrying them from the factory locations to the exterior membrane. Mitochondria, these structures are the power plants of the cell, producing the fuel that gives the cell its energy. Cell membrane, the exterior covering of the cell which regulates what enters and what leaves the cell. Microtubules, long hollow tubes, are the structures which give the cell its shape. And then there's the nucleus. The nucleus contains the data center which governs all the cell's activity. It contains the chromosomes which make up the blueprint for future generations. I'm giving you some of the structures that make up cells and their definitions of what they do. And notice this term used over and over again, factory. Now, the evolutionary assumption is that non-life became life. And the simplest component of life, they say, is the cell. So for a cell to exist, these structures are necessary. How could this possibly have come into existence by chance? We were referring to the nucleus. This is the location, the governing body of the cell. It contains the genetic information, the DNA molecule that makes up the chromosomes. The DNA molecule is the coded blueprint for life. And the reason life can be perpetuated from one generation to another generation is that the coded information is passed down. And what do we mean by coded information? Well, DNA, it's called a double helix, is made up of four different molecules that combine together. That is adenine with thymine and cytosine with guanine. And there you see this DNA molecule, and you see the steps on the ladder are made up of the combinations of these four different molecules. And it's the sequence of these combinations that's coded in the molecule that provides the data or the information that produces life. Now think of this. Each one of us originated from a single cell. And in that single cell, there was a nucleus. Within the nucleus, there were the chromosomes, which are made up of the DNA molecule. And you exist because of the coded information that was contained within that first cell from which you came, which, by the way, was the product of two other cells, one from the male parent, one from the female parent. Now, it has been calculated that if it were possible to store the coded blueprints for every person on the planet, over 6 billion, reducing that blueprint to the DNA molecules from which they came, that first cell, that this material could be stored in a container. What size do you think that container would be? Well, here's the answer. About the size of an aspirin tablet. You see, when we talk about the complexity of life, we're talking about a dimension that's, we can't even comprehend it. And the question must be answered. Could such complexity have arisen spontaneously by chance? I don't think so. When it comes to this combination sequence, adenine combines only with thymine, or A with T and C with G. And as we said, it's this sequence that produces the code of life. It's amazing. And it must be passed on for cellular function and for the perpetuation of life. Now, the evolutionary assumption is that mistakes in the code produce the variation of life, along with natural selection. Mutations, they say, are very significant in bringing about the variation through time. Well, do mutations occur? Well, of course. We've done all kinds of experiments through the years, for example, with Drosophila, the fruit fly. And they've been bombarded with everything you can imagine. Temperature changes, chemical changes, radiation. And numerous kinds of mutations have been induced in the fruit fly. For example, bent wings, no wings, different eye color variations. But you will note in every case, no one has ever seen anything different. It's always a fruit fly. So is it reasonable to say that mistakes in the genetic code can increase the complexity of life through time? Well, scientists recognize that the vast majority of mutations are degenerative, harmful, or lethal. Over 99%. Is this reasonable? As I mentioned, I'm always asked, especially when I'm on a secular radio program and I'm talking about creation, why I changed from evolution to creation. A few years ago, I was in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And the host of the program was rather hostile to creationists. On the way to the radio station, I heard him introducing the program, and he said, "Please, I want you to call in with all your difficult questions. We've got this creationist on this morning. We want to embarrass him." And he attempted to do that. The first question he asked me, he said, "I want to ask you this question. What caused you to change your position from a scientific view of evolution to this religious idea of creation? Could you just give me one thing?" I said, "Sir, it wasn't just one thing." He said, "Could you just give me one thing?" And I thought for a moment, and then I answered him this way. So one day, I came home, and I met my wife at the door, and she was crying. He said, "I don't want any kind of an emotional story. I want some facts." I said, "Sir, let me present what I'm going to say." So the reason she was crying, she just returned from the doctor's office. And the test had been returned. And the child that she'd been carrying for over 7 months had been determined to suffer from a severe mutation and would live and then die. And that's what happened. He said, "What's this got to do with you becoming a creationist?" I said, "Sir, you don't understand. You see, up until that point in my life, I believed that mutations were involved in shaping and forming life. But for the first time in my life, I came to an understanding. Mutations are degenerative and harmful, and they bring about death. And that's what happened. And you see, as a creationist, now I can understand. The reason we have mutations is because we live in a fallen world. The Creator created and things were perfect. Genesis chapter 1, verse 31. It was good, but something happened to that perfect creation. It became imperfect. And as a result of sin, we have degeneration and we have death. Mutations don't increase order and complexity. But the evolutionists insist that that's what happens. Now I want to show you a very interesting segment of this documentary film called The Unlocking the Mystery of Life. The Case for Intelligent Design by Alestra Productions. This is done by a group of scientists, most of them were former evolutionists, who now see the incredible design in living things, and particularly in the cell. And so we're going to look at this 4-minute segment of video, and it's going to be explaining to us what occurs in the nucleus during the process of protein synthesis. It's a computer animation, but it represents what takes place.
Chance, natural selection, and his own theory of self-organization had all failed to explain the origin of genetic information. Now Kenyon saw only one alternative.
We have not the slightest chance of a chemical evolutionary origin for even the simplest of cells. So the concept of the intelligent design of life was immensely attractive to me and made a great deal of sense, as it very closely matched the multiple discoveries in molecular biology.
In the years since Kenyon's rejection of chemical evolution, science has revealed the details of an entire system of information processing that bears the hallmarks of intelligent design. With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured. When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
This is absolutely mind-boggling to perceive at this scale of size such a finely tuned apparatus, a device that bears the marks of intelligent design and manufacture. And we have the details of an immensely complex molecular realm of genetic information processing. And it's exactly this new realm of molecular genetics where we see the most compelling evidence of design on the Earth.
what is taking place so that proteins can be produced is that in the nucleus, the chromosome separates and forms a template where a transfer molecule then goes through the pore of the nuclear wall, transported into the cytoplasm to the location of the ribosome, and there it becomes the template where various RNA molecules, transfer RNA molecules, bring amino acids to the location to produce the protein. And of course, as you could see, this was done by very specific patterns and direction. Obviously, the spontaneous generation of an amino acid, as we've talked about earlier, has the possibility of nil to occur, but through this process it occurs. And this is happening in our cells, all of our cells of our body, trillions of times every day. Could it have happened by chance, or does this point us towards the reality of an intelligent designer, creator? Now, our second video clip comes from the question of origins, and this is a short piece showing the complexity of bacteria. This is based on the research of Dr. Michael Behe and others who have come to the conclusion, when we examine life at the biochemical level, the molecular level, we see design that couldn't possibly have assembled by some spontaneous process of chance.
Evolution teaches that bacteria were one of the first life forms to evolve from chemicals. Many bacteria propel themselves with a type of miniature motor called a flagellum. These extremely efficient reversible motors rotate up to 100,000 revolutions per minute. The bacterial motor is similar to an electric motor. It has a filament that acts as a propeller, a universal joint, a stator and a rotor, and a drive shaft with bushings. Each part of the motor must function, or the bacteria will die. Since bacteria can start, stop, and change direction and speeds, they must have sophisticated sensors, switches, and control mechanisms. All of this is highly miniaturized. 8 million of these motors would fit in the cross-sectional area of a human hair. While bacteria are small, they are not simple.
Yet another incredible statement. 8 million of these motors would fit in the cross-section of a human hair. Again, that video clip comes from The Question of Origins, which is available in video and DVD. And one thing about The Question of Origins DVD that I would like to mention to you, on this DVD there are 8 different translations. So this is an excellent product if you're interested in sending something to a missionary in various parts of the world, including places that speak Russian and Spanish, Portuguese, and there are several other versions as well. Another major area that shows the vast complexity of life is in the insect kind. Another very good tool, in DVDs, 2 of them are the DVDs, The Incredible Creatures That Defy Evolution by Dr. Job Martin. And they very clearly show the complexity of life that cannot be explained by chance, pointing towards the reality of a designer. Now, let's move on and talk more specifically about our own bodies. How did it happen? Well, the human body, if we could break it down to the simplest component, would be the atom. Atoms make up molecules. Molecules, macromolecules, which formulate organelles. Those are structures that we've already looked at within cells. And then the cell. Cells are become tissues. Tissues make up organs. And organs make up organ systems, which make up organisms, you and me. So in order for us to exist, these are the various components that make up the human body. How did this come into existence? Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the biology of things that we, most cases, take for granted. For example, hearing. How do we hear? and what structures are necessary. You see, this morning, as you are listening to this presentation, there are frequencies that are coming to your ears through the PA system, from my voice, through the PA system, through the speakers, and they're coming to your ears. And this is transferred from a electromagnetic spectrum to a signal that's recorded in your brain, and everything that you hear will be recorded in memory in your brain for as long as you live. Well, the ear is a very, very complex organ made up of the outer ear, the inner ear, and the middle ear. Sound waves that come to your ear that are gathered via the auricle down through the channel to the eardrum cause the eardrum to vibrate, which then is transferred into the middle ear where there are three bones, the malleus, the incus, and the stapes. And this mechanical energy is then transferred towards the inner ear. And it's in the inner ear that we have this cochlear structure, looks like a snail, that if it were laid out horizontally, you would see is made up of three chambers. And it's in the middle chamber where the transfer of mechanical energy is transferred to the nervous system. An electrochemical stimulus is sent via the nerve systems to the brain. And it's in your brain that this information is processed and recorded and stored. Well, we've just briefly gone through this very complicated process, but evolutionists insist that hearing is merely the product of gradual, minute changes that have taken place over long periods of time. Is that reasonable? Or sight. As you are viewing these illustrations, your eyes are picking up frequencies from the electromagnetic spectrum, and then they are also converted and stored in memory in your brain, and what you see, what you observe, will also be recorded in memory in your brain for as long as you live. And of course, the eye is an incredible complex organ with muscles that adjust the eye to look in various directions. The eye itself, a very, very complex organ that adjusts the amount of light that comes into the eye through the iris. And then the lens of the eye, which focuses the light on the back of the eye. And the lens can be adjusted in thickness based on minute, tiny ligaments. The back of the eye, the electromagnetic spectrum frequencies of the light spectrum are converted to an electrochemical stimulus and then transmitted via the optic nerve to the brain. And that information is recorded. Again, we see the incredible complexity. But evolutionists insist that it just simply happened. For example, let me read to you a statement about sight, the eye, and seeing by Steve Parker. And this is his statement. The eye is like a camera. Or rather, a camera is like an eye. Since eyes have been around for several hundred million years longer than cameras. Both the camera and the eye have light-proof protective cases and a small transparent window through which light enters. The amount of light coming in must be controlled to prevent overexposure and damage in very bright light to admit as much light as possible in very dim conditions. In the eye, this job is done by the iris, which becomes wider or narrower and so changes the size of the pupil, the window. The camera has a similar mechanism, a circular shutter that changes the size of the aperture or window. Without a focusing mechanism, both the eye and a camera would just see a huge multicolored blur. A lens carries out the fine focusing of light rays and forms a clear, sharp image. On the retina of the eye and on the film in a camera, the two focusing mechanisms are, however, slightly different. In the eye, the lens itself changes shape to focus the light. In a camera, the lens moves backward and forward for focusing. In the camera, the image is recorded in a light-sensitive chemical. In a film, the eye also uses light-sensitive chemicals in the retina, but the chemicals transform light into electrical messages, which are sent to the brain. So here's this evolutionist that looks at the complexity of the eye, compares it to a camera, recognizes that a camera is something that has been engineered, but cannot see the handiwork of a creator. Why is that? The human body is made up of various organs which are necessary so that we can exist. Evolutionists assume that these organs have evolved. Now stop for a moment and think. For example, the circulatory system. The circulatory system, which is made up of the heart, the arteries, which take the blood away from the heart, to the capillary system, which take the blood to the cells. From the cells, the blood must be returned to the heart by a venous system that must be in place. And then the heart pumps the blood to the lungs or the pulmonary system so the blood can be reoxygenated. Now, all of this has to be in place, or there's no organism with a circulatory system. There is no possible mechanism that can be pointed to that would explain how a circulatory system could have evolved. And yet evolutionists claim that it did. Or the digestive system. The mouth, the esophagus, the stomach, the liver, the pancreas, gallbladder, small and large intestine. All of this is required for digestion to occur. Evolutionists insist that it's the product of evolution. But what mechanism can you come up with that would explain how this could come into existence by a process of gradual change? It has to come on the scene functional from the beginning. Or the urinary system, which takes out metabolic waste from the blood, requiring the kidneys and a bladder. How could such a system have evolved? And when we look at the system and it's made up of the cells that make it up, again, as we go down in detail, we see greater complexity. A system that's functioning not by chance, but by design. How could an organ evolve? How could a heart evolve? How could a brain evolve? That's the question. Then we look at reproduction. Here you see a developing fetus. The amazing, complex infant developing within a mother's womb. In order for there to be reproduction, there must be a male and a female in the species. The male must have to have the reproductive organs to reproduce himself by one half genetically through a complex process called meiosis. That is the production of the sperm cell, containing half the number of chromosomes as the adult. The same with the female. Must have the reproductive organs to reproduce herself by one half genetically to produce the egg cell. The reason being is when the two unite, now we have the same number of chromosomes as the adult. And then, after fertilization, that cell begins to divide. 1 becomes 2, becomes 4, becomes 8, becomes 16, and through a complex process of embryological development, an infant develops within a mother's womb that must be in place to a specific period of time when the child is born. Now, during this process, there has to be a special circulatory system within the fetus's circulatory system to shunt the blood so that the blood of the fetus isn't pumped to the lungs, otherwise it would drown. The blood from the mother through the umbilical cord provides the oxygen. And when the child is born, at the moment of birth, something happens within the heart. There is a hole between the ventricles where the blood is shunted. And at the moment of birth, there's a flap that comes down. And then the child begins to breathe. Think of the complexity. How did it happen? I've had many opportunities to lecture in Russia. As mentioned earlier, Institute for Science and Atheism. And other places, higher education. Many conferences on the subject of origins, for we have discovered that in Russia there are many people are open to hearing an alternative to Darwinian evolution. It was several years ago, Dr. Gish and I were speaking in Moscow at a symposium on creation. My topic was problems for evolution. And one of the things that I presented was the impossibility for evolution to explain how reproduction could occur. And so I went through in some detail just what we briefly described here today, the impossibility of explaining how reproduction occurred, the difference in the sexes, the complexity of embryological development, and the birthing of a child and the development of the heart. And in the question period, a Russian scientist stood to his feet. There were about 400 scientists and engineers that were in attendance. And he said that he didn't have a question, but he had a comment. He said, all of my life, he said, I simply have accepted what I have been told. He said, today is the first time I've presented something that I've been challenged with, and I don't have any answers. He said, but there must be answers. He said, there's a number of my colleagues here who are experts in evolution. Can anybody here come up with some kind of an explanation to explain how reproduction could have occurred through the Darwinian worldview? And there was silence. Finally, one gentleman stood up. He said, I'm sorry, I don't have an answer to the question, but he said, I have a suggestion. He said, in our midst today is Russia's most prominent evolutionist, Dr. Gao from the University of Moscow. He said, Dr. Gao, do you have any suggestions? And I will never forget this as long as I live. I looked over to my right, and from about the same distance from me to that first row of chairs, there was an old gentleman, and he stood to his feet, and he had two canes, and he was trembling and shaking. He was in his late 80s. He said, these are some questions which I have entertained all of my life, but I have to admit to you, he said, at the present time, I don't have any answers, but, he said, if you give me some more time, maybe I'll be able to come up with something. You see, there are no answers. But I've also discovered that in the former Soviet Union, many people who were forced to believe in evolution for so many years, when they are presented the evidence, they don't challenge you. I will never forget one particular occasion. It was in St. Petersburg. I had given a presentation on creation, 45 minutes. And after the presentation, a man came up to me, and through the translator, he said, I have written 7 textbooks that have the word evolution in the title. And I thought, well, I'm in for some opposition. And then he said this, tonight in 45 minutes, I have learned I've wasted my entire life. You see, those kind of responses are quite typical in parts of the world that at one time were forced to believe in evolution. But here in North America, I don't find that that's the case. It seems that here in America, evolution is being defended with a greater zeal than ever. And those who challenge it, well, as we mentioned earlier, Richard Leakey says that anybody that challenges evolution is out of their minds. Richard Dawkins, the promoter of evolution in the UK, says that the design and complexity that we see in life does not point towards a designer. He has written a book called The Blind Watchmaker, Why the Evidence of Evolution Reveals a Universe Without Design. And I quote to you from his book, page 5. Paley's argument is made with passionate sincerity and is informed by the best biological scholarship of the day. But it is wrong, gloriously and utterly wrong. What is he referring to here? Paley is the one who had the argument, a wristwatch requires a watchmaker. And if that is the case, the hand or the wrist that the wristwatch is on also has been designed. But Dawkins says that's wrong. The analogy between telescope and eye, between watch and living organism is false. All appearances to the contrary, the only watchmaker in nature is the blind forces of physics, albeit deployed in a very special way. A true watchmaker has foresight. He designs his cogs and springs and plans their interconnections with a future purpose in his mind's eye. Natural selection, the blind unconscious process which Darwin discovered and which we now know as the explanation for the existence and apparently personal form of all life, has no purpose in mind. So, there you have it. By a scientist who's an evolutionist. He refuses to look at the evidence. From The Rise of Life, John Reeder, this following statement, page 9. He said, "The simplest explanation attributes life on earth to the work of some supernatural force which has ordered that things be so. This explanation has the unquestioned merit of encompassing everything. There is nothing that the invocation of a supernatural force cannot explain. No question remains if God was behind it all. Belief in the omnipotent God is all that is required." And of course, he's writing this with a sarcastic tone. But really what he's saying is true. You see, if chance and time doesn't explain the complexity of life, we have no alternative. The alternative is a creator. From the publication called Teaching About Evolution and the Nature of Science by the National Academy of Sciences, they determined the scientific curriculum for schools in the United States. From page 3, we read, "In short, biological evolution accounts for three of the most fundamental features of the world around us, the similarities among living things, the diversity of life, and many features of the physical world we inhabit. Explanations of these phenomena in terms of evolution draws on results from physics, chemistry, geology, and other sciences. Thus, evolution is the central organizing principle that biologists use to understand the world. To teach biology without explaining evolution deprives students of a powerful concept that brings great order and coherence to our understanding life." And in the book of Psalms 139, verses 14 to 18, this is what the Bible states about the complexity of life. "I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they were written, the days fashioned for me when as yet there was none of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would be more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with you." Two views on the complexity of life. Evolution,